Hello and welcome to I Am the Egg Pod with me. Well, I'm not Chris Shaw, I'm Samira Ahmed. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland discussing the Beatles and solo Beatles albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, I'm joined by podcaster, Beatles fan and creator of I Am the Egg Pod, Chris Shaw. Hello, Chris Shaw.
Hello, Samira Ahmed.
Do you know what this bit is like? It's like that bit in The Sea of Monsters in Yellow Submarine where that Hoover monster has swallowed up everything and then swallows up himself.
Yes.
And then we've come out the other side and we're in that white, blank, alternative universe with Jeremy and his food.
Yes.
That's where we are right now.
We are in Boobland.
We're in Boobland! So the reason for this is, it's how many years since you created this podcast?
It's 5 years ago today, 13th of January.
That's amazing. And how many downloads and listens have you had in that time?
I don't know.
I remember when you passed a million. I think you messaged me.
I messaged everybody.
That's a couple of years ago. I just thought, I mean, I'm someone who was a guest relatively early on. And so I thought it would be fun to talk to you about how it's grown. And I'm fascinated by how, you know, there's something about a tipping point, isn't there? When the word of mouth spreads, the guests start volunteering themselves, you're having to fight people off want to come on your podcast now. And as you know, Paul McCartney's people heard my episodes with you, and that's how I got to interview him at his book launch. So, you know, that's,
it's
the
surreal.
Love you give is equal to the love you take, Chris.
It is, but it has been amazing. It's like this whole little online world that I'm nothing to do with, because by day I'm just this boring old fart who sits at a desk. But online, it's like this magical mystery tour world going on. And I don't feel part of it at all. I'm just sort of watching it like everybody else. So it's very surreal, but I do love it.
Where did the idea come from?
Yeah, I think because I'm guessing you and I are sort of similar ages. And I'm sure I had a conversation with you before. Growing up as a toddler in the 70s and a teen in the 80s, I always felt gutted that I'd missed out on the 60s.
Yeah.
Because you'd see footage and you'd hear all that music and everything was so much more colourful and all the imagination and experimentation. And totally. It just seemed like such a cool era to live in. I mean, there was some horrendous stuff going on, but the music for me, it blew my socks off at the time as a toddler. And I did have a circle of friends from school, still today actually, and we were all into the Beatles because it was the same sort of thing, you inherit your parents' record collections. And it's all we talked about. And then we hit teenage years and, you know, old enough to go in pubs. And we would just sit there, just boring everybody. So we were effectively doing Egg Pod episodes back in the 80s or whatever. And it was just something I thought I'd like to hear. Because this started 2017, I thought, oh, I'd like to do this. And I couldn't find anything else out there. I just wanted to do it. I wanted to hear people talking about the albums and all the songs. There were a few Beatles podcasts out there, but they tended to be very serious and kind of dissecting the frog and sucking all the joy out of what made the Beatles, really. I was like, I'm not enjoying this. There's no joy in this. So I wanted to do something like that. But it was just a simple idea, talk about the Beatles and their songs.
So it's a couple of things that I observed about your podcast which seem to be key to why it's so good and why it's such a success. One is, as you say, you're driven by the joy of the Beatles as a band that people listen to and enjoy and come back to. But it's combined with a kind of technical expertise. And I've seen you, because you've come in occasionally when we've recorded episodes and you brought your gear into my office and we've sat and I've just been impressed by it. It's like, oh, this is quite serious. And you know and have done your research on little things about how they did takes. So there's a combination of expert musical knowledge with straightforward, just unspecialised passion. So it's very accessible, but I learn something every time I listen to an episode or talk to you. And there's also that, what's the word for it? You're a bit of an audiophile because you made that amazing mix that opens and closes the episode where it's a kind of strange segue of tracks that you've mixed in some weird way. I don't know how you did that. Do you want to talk us a bit through that idea, the kind of the packaging of it?
It was very much making it up as I was going along. A phrase I often use, I have no idea to this day what I'm doing. I just very much press play and record. But I used to do mashups back in the early noughties, and where you'd grab a Beatles song and you'd filter out the vocals and put it on the backing of a different song. So I did like I did Revolver and Sgt. Pepper albums, but this was just one I did with a friend in America. It was Sgt. Pepper reprise. It was called Cracked Pepper, which I thought was a great title.
That is a great title.
So, yeah, that was, yeah, Sgt. Pepper reprise. I forget what else. It's got all bits of Savoy truffle and, yeah, all random bits glued together. And I just thought, yeah, well, I need a theme tune. I'll just use that because it was lying around doing nothing. So, yeah, that'll do.
And the title came from Rob Manuel. And remind those who don't know who he is, because he's quite someone.
He is. He's an amazing player. He's, ever since the internet's been out, he's been there lurking away, subverting it. It still does beta.com, which has, you know, so many people have come from that website. It was effectively like photoshopping animations, very puerile, very silly. But it was one of the first big things on the web.
A bit kind of pop culture, yeah. Playful satire.
Yeah.
Blogs. Sorry, that sounds like we're overanalyzing it, but it is good fun. It's been around for a very long time.
Yeah, so he ran that, and now he's doing loads of online bots.
He does a Yoko Ono bot, doesn't he?
He does, which is superb.
Which is quite funny.
And they're all really lovely ones as well. There's Clickbait Robot that I love. But yeah, he sort of does Fesshole.
When people confess terrible things they've done anonymously, yeah. He puts them out on social media.
Yeah, and he's doing live shows as well, which is amazing.
Excellent.
But so we were chatting. I said, yeah, I want to do it. Will you come on? And he said, what are you going to call it? I don't know. But I was thinking of like submarine or strawberry, sort of Beatles-related words, rather than just call it the Beatles podcast. And he suggested We Are the Walruses. I thought, oh, yeah, I really like that. And then I thought, oh, I am the egg pod. And that was it. It literally, I am the egg pod. And he said, yeah, they'll just call it egg pod eventually. And I love that they do, because it's such a ridiculous word.
And you've got, and we are egg podders.
That was Neil Innes came up with that term. Hello, and welcome to I Am the Egg Pod, hosted by me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, I'm joined by singer-songwriter, musician, and a man who taught a whole generation the word pusillanimous. Hang on. How's it going again?
Pusillanimous.
Thank you. Neil Innes.
Hello, Chris.
Hi, Neil.
Hello, egg podders. Actually, Tom McGuinness from Manfred Mann, yes. I've known for years. Anyway, he got me in touch with him. He said, why don't you come to these SODS lunches? Mm. SODS are Songwriters of Distinction.
Right.
And twice a year, we have these lunches down in Barnes. And I said, well, what's something going on? He said, well, It's fun, you know. Last time he said he was there, he said I saw Adam Faith and Noddy Holder and Bruce Welch all in a huddle in the corner. So I went over and said, "Wonder what they're talking about." You know, he went over and he found out they were talking about their winter fuel allowance.
But that leads me to the next obvious thing to ask is, you know, you quite quickly managed to speak to people who had a direct connection to the Beatles story. So Neil Innes, who of course worked with George Harrison on The Ruttles, Julia Baird, John Lennon's half-sister.
Again, Springwood, you've now got the Quarrymen rehearsing there. Tell me about your memories of that.
In the kitchen. Well, in the kitchen, because my mother not only didn't mind, she joined in. So the other one, Colin Hampton, the drummer, his mother would allow them to practice in their house on Saturday afternoon when she was out shopping. But my mother was waiting for them and took Rod Davis's banjo. And he said, well, where was your mother's banjo? He says that to me. I said, it was in my bedroom in the cupboard. But my grandfather, Papa, brought that from sea, and he taught my mother, and my mother had taught John. So John was playing banjo chords for a time on the guitar. And then, of course, they didn't have microphones anywhere in the old school halls. So they played them as loud as they possibly could and broke strings all the time. And one of them would constantly be running backstage to put another string. And John or whoever was playing would take another instrument. It could be a banjo, it could be a guitar, it could be the wrong guitar.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. It's to do Nobody's Child.
Well,
Tony Sheridan and the Beatles did that as well, but lyrically it's...
Absolutely. I met Tony Sheridan and we had a long talk at One Beatle Week. I have Nobody's Child written out in front of my computer.
Oh, Wow.
It's reminding me of how John felt, because again, in those days, I don't suppose it would happen so much now, where the child is so much more the focal point of a family, that no one discussed anything with the child. John had to cope with this. Tony Sheridan said to me, well, he told me a lot of things actually that I'm not going to say, but he said that was his song. And Rod Davis said he used to sit and play it. It's too sore to think about.
No mommy's kisses and no daddy's smile. Nobody wants me. I'm nobody.
Tell me a bit about how and when you started to realise that you were going to connect to the sort of the ongoing world of Beatles oral history.
It took a while. Because I did about three or four episodes in 2018 until April, and then I just stopped because it took so long, still does take so long to do. But I think Kate Robbins, I saw, was on Twitter, and I literally asked her, so would you come on? She said yes, and that for me was just amazing, just Paul McCartney's second cousin. And I thought, I can't beat this. And I sort of gave up after that. I thought that's going to be the peak.
I think something is the greatest Beatles song that George wrote, of George's compositions. For me, it was the first time I really liked one of his compositions, because I did tend to sort of, as a kid, listen to the other tracks. I never listened to the ones that Ringo sang, and I never really gave that much time and attention to George's tracks. I do now, as an adult, but as a kid, I was more interested in the Lennon McCartney ones. I don't know why, but I thought this was beautiful.
Yeah.
And it's been horribly covered by people. I don't like the way Shirley Bassey actually kills him. Something will he moves. I try to be late, not a lover. It's horrible. Stop it. It's a beautiful Beatles song.
Impressive.
And it was you, actually, because in around September that year, I hadn't done any. And people started emailing me and saying, oh, you're going to do some more. And I contacted you. I think that was probably through Twitter. But I knew, basically, I wanted people that I liked, and I knew that they were into the Beatles. And obviously, I searched your name and the word Beatles, and there was all this, yeah, she's a fan. And when you came on, it just changed everything. Because,
really?
Oh, man, totally. When you came on, you were talking about 60s subculture and the emotions and the feelings.
Yeah, like, I remember it because I was all of 1 year old.
Well, yeah, but again, it's the same. That's why I hooked onto it, because you're exactly the same as me. I was so into the 60s and I'm gutted I missed out being there. And yeah, once you've been on, I could then say, approach like David Quantick, because I love David Quantick. I approached him and said, hey, I've had Samira Ahmed on. He's like, oh yeah, I'm coming on.
There are people who pretend to like things, and I'm sure there are people who pretend to like Revolution Number 9. I am not one of those. I have loved Revolution. Once I got over it, the shock, it's an absolutely fantastic piece. I'll call it music. It's crafted beautifully. You know the way that the free poster with the album, everyone doing weird things, is, you know, it's laid out beautifully. It, you know, it's not a narrative, but Revolution Number 9 is like that. It's just perfect. I mean, me and my friends at the time used to quote, take this brother, may you serve you well, you become naked, the Watusi, the twist, all these moments.
El Dorado.
Yeah, which I'm sure is Eamon Andrews.
You think he's
this
there.
Is your life. El Dorado. It's a wonderfully crafted number nine, right? It's just a brilliant piece of sound, of collage, whatever. And it's a marvellous, wonderful piece of stuff. Again, running out of things to say about it because it just is what it is. But hearing Yoko come in, John, there's bits of comedy, bits of sound collage. It's a genuinely well-crafted piece of sound. And it's a massive, massive shock because, you know, if you want to do... It's on the same side as Honey Pie, as we have mentioned.
Yes, yeah.
But it's the band who, you know, a year before had done When I'm 64 and Your Mother Should Know. And you know, there's always that suggestion that Paul was a bit miffed because he wanted to be the avant-garde one.
Yeah.
But he never actually got round to it.
No. Well, wasn't it Carnival of Light?
Carnival of Light, which nobody has heard, and for all we know could just be him playing the banjo and singing George Formby songs. His use, or the Beatles' use, of tape loops is a lot more catchy
than an awful lot of avant-garde stuff that I've heard. I think just whatever pop sensibility Lennon has, even in a 9-minute looped collage piece, he knows where to put the hooks in. You know, he knows where to have the breaks and the variety. The fact he keeps bringing up the number nine riff like a hook on a pop song means that, you know, even he's somebody who should be entrusted with a studio, whereas an awful lot of avant-garde people had not got a clue about melody and song structure.
Yeah,
it's a little symphony, whatever a 9-minute symphony is called. It's a proper piece of music that's just done with voices and sounds. It's immensely listenable.
I want to go and listen to that.
I think
now.
You should. Oh, we forgot to mention just that beautiful intro. Can you take me? What's it called? Can you take
me
back?
Can you take me back where I came from?
Which is just, it just works so well. It's a fragment, and it works better as a fragment. If we'd had a whole song, it wouldn't work. But it's just coming in, it's saying, what's going on? What it is, it's the rabbit down the rabbit hole. It's
yes.
Saying, come with me, we're going somewhere. And when you get, it's like, oh my God, I didn't expect, I thought we were going to have a nice little acoustic sing song. Instead, we're in Abbey Road. We're literally in Abbey Road with a tape op, you know, chart counting in number nine. And we're in this nightmare world. It's a fantastic world. And then we come out in what's obviously a totally deliberate decision with Ringo singing the schmaltziest song with an, you know, the album ends with an opera singer and Ringo Starr saying goodnight.
Yeah.
Goodnight, everyone, everywhere. It's beautiful.
It is. The rabbit going down the rabbit hole. No one could have foretold what was about to happen for the rest of the album.
No. It's perfectly placed as the penultimate track. You know, the last act, as it were, it just says, right, we've done everything. What's left? You know, we've done rock and roll, ballads, 1920s songs, pastiches, psychedelia, everything, insomnia. And now we are going to go down. And we're just going to compress all of Alice in Wonderland into 9 or so minutes. But don't worry, because we're going to rescue at the end. Ringo's here. It's bedtime.
So
it's funny, because I thought I came on because I'd seen you'd had David Quantick on. So we obviously have a false memory of this.
I can't remember. I'm sure it was you first. But Ian Lee definitely came on because he'd been on.
Oh, Ian is brilliant.
He is brilliant. And he picked Give My Regards to Brooke, because I thought at the beginning, all the big albums like Abbey Road, Revolver, yeah, Rubber Soul, they went straight away. And he came in with Give My Regards to Broad Street. And that kind of changed it for me as well, because then I thought, well, yeah, I can do these not so famous or unloved, forgotten albums as well. So, yeah, he was so funny.
I think it would be a wonderful bootleg that would have been passed around. Have you seen this? It's the ridiculous storyline. It's...
Ridiculous, I would say weak at best. It's not the strongest plot.
Wafer thin. Well, the storyline is, we should say, for those who haven't seen it, so he's recorded a new album. The master tapes have gone missing. He's got 24 hours to find the tapes. Otherwise, he gets his ass owned by like an American conglomerate or something.
Yeah.
They end up owning Paul McCartney. So there was a guy working for him who had been an ex-con. And
Harry.
Harry. You know, I just wanted to give him a chance. You know, I think everyone should have a second chance, you know. Yeah. And
no, Paul. No, he's a bad one.
No, he's great, you know. So the story is, has Harry stolen this tape?
Yes, has he?
The end of the film. Let's jump to the ending. The end of the film is...
Right, spoiler alert, if anybody does want to watch this, but spoiler alert.
End of
alert.
The film is... He finds Harry locked in the toilets of Broad Street Station, right? And he's not. Yeah. He fell asleep and he got locked in, right? So the tapes haven't gone missing. So that's a really weak ending. Yeah. But then to compound it, there's another weak ending in that actually it was all a dream anyway. It was all a dream anyway. I remember being 10 and writing a story and the ending was, and they woke up and it was all a dream and getting told off.
Yes.
For that. And this is the problem with it. This is the problem with it. Because he was such a huge star, because he was a Beatle, and I've heard, and this is partly why I've heard Press to Play was such a weak album. No one had the guts to tell him no. And those that did tell, there's a great story. I can't remember the name of, there were two producers for Press to Play. And
Hugh Padgham.
Yeah, I think it was Padgham.
Yeah.
And McCartney presented a song, and Hugh went, well, I don't think it's one of your best. And McCartney turns to him and says something along the lines of, how many fucking number ones have you had? And that kind of silenced him. And all right,
it's
yeah,
great.
Right.
I love it.
And I'd imagine it would be the same with this. Either everyone was too afraid to say that dream, the whole thing being a dream, Paul. I don't know. Or if they did, he would turn on them. Yeah. I'd imagine, you know. So weak plot.
Yeah, and again, going back to the ending, the one thing that we do miss out as well is the reason that Harry went in the room was because he needed a shit. So basically, the whole film. And all this, I love Harry. You know, he's a great guy underneath that con man exterior. But the whole film is based around a bloke needing a shit, and it was a dream anyway.
That's
so Paul McCartney dreamt about a man having a dump.
Should have been more explicit than that, because that's not a bad premise.
And do you know one other thing I realise is around the time we're talking, which is, you know, that sort of period of kind of Christmas, New Year, December 1979 was when they first showed all the Beatles films on TV, and we taped them all off the TV. And so I watched them repeatedly for years after. And that was quite instrumental for me because I was 11 when that happened. I just started senior school. And I remember, you know, you talked at the beginning about finding all your friends at school who are all into it. I went into school wearing a Beatles badge from January 1979, which is the first time I think I'd worn a pop badge. So there was definitely all of us. We were part of this tribe scattered across the British Isles in particular. Totally. I think those films were a big part of how we learnt to... You know, it was more than just the music, wasn't it? You kind of got an understanding of them as people, as this bunch of fellas you'd like to hang out with.
Yeah.
Who were fun. And of course, that was the, you know, bringing it full circle to the Get Back documentary. We did get to hang out with them, admittedly, when they were a bit older and more jaded, but still fun, fun to be with.
Yeah. I've only sort of worked this out recently going backwards, but I think as a toddler, I do remember the Red and the Blue albums being played in the background. But I think it must have been around 1976. I would have been six. And they re-released all the Beatles singles. Because I remember them being on the radio. And I was trying to work out why. And that was around that time. And they'd issued Yesterday as a single. And I think that must be how I knew the music. And I loved it immediately. And again, it was that Born at the Wrong Time. It was so much better than all the current music that was being played at the same time. And yes, those Beatles films, my memory of those was, it was so exciting because you didn't really see much of the Beatles footage. You saw photos. I had the Roy Carr, Tony Tyler book. I think you got that.
An illustrated record. And I used to pore over that. You know, it was the closest you got to sort of travelling through time from their origins to their solo years.
And as a kid, I just stare at the album covers, think, oh, one day I'm going to own that album. And I remember being obsessed by the White Album, because I hadn't got it at that point, but looking at all the track listing, and what's this? Everybody's Got Something to Hide Except From Me. You know, it was this strange other world that I couldn't wait to explore. But those Beatles films, that was such a big thing, because you saw them moving, talking, and kind of acting occasionally. And yeah, they were real people then. And yeah, that was a huge impact.
What was your favourite film as a child of the Beatles films?
Oh, Help.
Yeah. See, I think it's really interesting. And although I always loved A Hard Day's Night, and I'd now argue it's my favourite, Help was the one I think a lot of us bonded with because it was colour. It was a fantastical sort of cartoon-like adventure, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, you think millions of people at the time, that would be the first time they would have seen the Beatles in colour.
Yeah.
Because there was like the Liverpool 63 thing that was in the cinemas. But other than that, most people, well, everyone would have had black and white TVs. Yeah, it must have been such an amazing thing at the time.
And also, the way that a lot of that plot early on, you know, it sets them in Britain. Like, you know, they live in that suburban street in Twickenham, you know, behind the four doors. And the idea that, you know, they were wandering around London streets posting letters and evading dodgy death cults and things.
And hapless professors. Yeah, that I'd be quite happy for the whole film to be set in that house, to be honest. And maybe cut to the snow scenes and then back to the house. Doesn't really need all the other stuff, I don't think.
I love that idea because there was something sitcom-like, wasn't there? That was what was really clever. It threw together all kinds of different ideas. But there was something sitcom-like about these four fellas. And, of course, you can see straight away. I mean, that is the real premise, in a way, of the Monkees, even though I gather it was inspired by A Hard Day's Night. But it's the four of them in their wacky home.
Yes, I think because the Monkees... Wasn't it the pilot episode? They had a manager and they were showing it around all the previews and everyone said, no, you can't do it. So all they did, they edited out the manager. So now they didn't have the father figure. It's these four blokes living on their own, which is, yeah, just like Help.
Yeah, you know, I hadn't thought about that. Because, of course, Hard Day's Night, a big part of it is the premise of the manager, the hapless manager and his sister trying to desperately shepherd them, corral them like wayward sheep from one pen to the next. And in Help, that's completely missing. And it's got that properly surreal sense of it being a sealed world like Alice in Wonderland, where it has its own internal logic. But actually, who was organising their schedule? Why do they have a recording date that day? Who took that taxi for them? You know, when they're all coming out the house to get into their limo.
It's very surreal. They were great, those films. But I had a scrapbook at the time. I just started. It must have been after that, actually. Yeah, it started at the beginning of January 80. And it was things like the World Records Club, or whatever it was called, that looked like a crate had been released. And I think, I can't afford that. I was nine. And there was so much Beatles activity because McCartney 2 had come out and coming up. And it was such an exciting time.
I know. That's for the first Beatles album, Groggy, I bought brand new. No, actually, the first one I bought was Hard Day's Night. But I remember buying McCartney 2, and I think I said to you, it was like very exciting thinking, oh, I can buy a new record by a Beatle. Like, they're putting out new music. I forget how young they were.
I know.
It was like, he wasn't even 40 then, was he, in 1980?
No. Yeah, you're definitely right about those films, because that was the real start of my passion. And I remember around November, December, that Andy Peebles kept doing little stings coming up. We were interviewing John Lennon. And there was a sting with John going, hi, everybody, don't forget to listen to my interview with Andy Peebles. We'll see you all in January 1981. And we're going to be touring. And I was like, yes. And I said to my mum at the time, am I allowed to go to London on my own? Because John Lennon might be touring. And she was like, maybe, we'll see. It would never have happened. But it was so exciting.
Oh, Chris, I could see this being some kind of film premise in which the 9-year-old you stows away on a train and sneaks into the gig, and it ends with, you know, but obviously it was never to be.
That's Paddington, isn't it?
It's Paddington. Take your own marmalade sandwiches.
In this episode, I'm joined by radio and television broadcaster and the first female presenter on Radio 1, who is longest serving presenter and also legend, Annie Nightingale.
Hello, Chris.
You were saying this one is very accessible. Sounds like Woman, which
Woman, that destroyed me. When I knew we were going to do this chat, I just sort of listened to it. I still can't listen to it. It affected me so much. Even just thinking about it, I do get very emotional about music anyway. I'm glad I do. So why I do what I do, I guess. But that song, even
why
mentioned.
Give you a hug?
Oh,
you're making me cry now.
Oh no, well, you see, that's a terrible thing, isn't it? But that, yeah, the fact that John understood feminism and his compassion. I actually played Working Class Hero on Radio 1, by mistake.
Oh no,
the unexpurgated
really?
Version. And it was not at midnight either, you know, it was quite early in the day.
How did that go?
Not well.
No, I was just going to say, when you said about guests, it's very much, I like it happening so I don't have to do anything. Because I think somebody on Twitter suggested Jeff Lloyd and they tagged him and we sort of hooked up. And he as you know, he's amazing. He loves his Beatles as well.
And he does a show, doesn't he, on
Radio Sirius,
show.
I think.
Sirius, which is amazing. I remember hearing it. He did a special one for the Get Back programme release.
Yeah, he's brilliant. Next we have Eleanor Ring... Eleanor Ringpiece. Next we have Eleanor Rigby, and it's the strings only version. Yeah. Sorry, I can't...
Sorry. You know, you've just ruined that song for everybody after more than 50 years of being one of the jewels in the Beatles' crown. Everybody's just going to hear Eleanor Ringpiece now.
I saw an advert for Viz on the way here. I blame them. Anyway. But he came on, and at the end of it, he said, oh, you should get Rachel Burden on. She loves the Beatles. I was like, oh, could you pass on? So he passed on the message.
And of course, she came with Nikki Campbell.
Well, she came on her own first. She did Magical Mystery Tour.
Oh.
which was brilliant. I just loved doing that. And then Nikki Campbell contacted me and said, why have you had her on? You haven't asked me. I was like, yes, please.
There's one sublime bit on it, though, when he sings for the first time. You're asking me, will my love grow? And his voice kind of breaks a bit.
Cracks.
Yeah. It's beautiful. Yeah.
Because we, what we do know, he doesn't know, but what we do know is it's all going to come crashing down around him. Don't mean to laugh at that. It's a tragic love tale.
Yeah, of course.
But at least Eric wasn't doing the guitar solo.
Yeah, so true.
Orcs, I think they say. The kids. And it's very much been like that, and I love it, because I love... I don't want... When I first did the... I think the second episode it was, I had Ben Wheatley on, and in my mind I'm thinking, wow, if I've got Ben Wheatley, maybe I could get Martin Scorsese, you know, and
that was kind of... Yeah.
Lucy in the Sky, we're veering into Lewis Carroll territory here.
And not LSD.
Not for the first time. Definitely not LSD. No. It was a painting by Julian Lennon.
Yes.
There may have been a hint of LSD inspiring the lyrics. Yeah.
Well, Lewis Carroll and LSD, isn't it, really?
And the fact that's more laudanum, isn't it?
Well, it's such a coincidence. Such a coincidence that it's called Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, though, isn't it, really?
Yeah. He ate oranges in Nigeria.
That classic. But that was the painting that Paul McCartney's son did.
Yeah, that's...
And then I just had no interest. I had my problem, I don't have any ambition. I'm quite happy just to do this. I don't want to be a rock critic or anything. I just love doing this. And I just thought, no, I just want to speak to people I like who are interesting and funny. And, yeah, that's kind of what I still do, I think.
Well, I think you've identified something else, which is there's a modesty about you, but also a kindness. I can't remember if I said this earlier, but you're very kind and warm and... You know, as you know, I hesitate to use the phrase healing process, but actually, you know, I remember coming on, the first thing I did after my employment tribunal finished, and I knew I'd have a long wait, I'd have a wait about 2 months for the result, was I knew I was looking forward to doing a recording with you. We did the George Harrison album, eponymous George Harrison album. And just sitting chatting to you about how much we loved the Beatles was such a lovely thing to do after I'd been through that. And you know, you were sending me lovely little gifts during the tribunal. So it's just, I do think there's something very special, and you're going to have to accept this, you're going to have to leave this in the edit, about the fact that, you know, you're not about point scoring, you're not about showing off how clever you are. You genuinely are having fun conversations, and your whole approach comes from a place of love and kindness.
Wow,
it's very 60s counterculture.
I do remember being very shocked, because I think we'd agreed the date to record that episode. Yeah. And then obviously, like, you're on the front page of the news every day. And I think, oh, man, Samira's, that's the last thing she's going to want to do. So I can't believe you went through with it. But I'm glad it was good for you.
Yeah, well, you know, it's so many ways in which I think you probably might be aware from emails you get from listeners. You know, it's had a big impact. So I now find if I'm walking towards Broadcasting House, sometimes I'll bump into Nikki Campbell and we will always stop and he will, you know, we were talking about, oh, the new Revolver... you know, extended re-release. So there's a whole bond between anyone who's been on the podcast. We see, recognise each other in the street now and we talk to each other. But also I think it's all opened our sense to being connected to a bigger community who just love the music. And as I say, it's not about being in-depth musophiles. It starts just from a place of enjoying the music. I have to ask as well about the Get Back epic, which I think was suggested to you, where you did an episode for each day of the Get Back calendar. That was quite an epic. You were doing that last year, weren't you? A year ago.
Yeah, it was a nightmare, but I loved it because Joel Morris phoned me up and he said, I've got this great idea. And I thought about it and I thought, because originally we planned maybe if I got about 10 guests, we could do 2 days each. But then I started asking people and then people started asking me if they could come on. So it was going to be 22 guests in, and I think I started it in December. So it had to be ready by January.
Oh, no.
And it was, I said to my wife, I was like, can I do, am I allowed to do this? Because I'm going to ruin Christmas. She was like, oh, yeah, okay. So we had Christmas in February, I think it was.
Oh. And, were you working on Christmas Day editing?
Actually, no, Christmas Day, I think.
Please tell me
no.
You took Christmas Day off.
Yeah, but I think I did one on Boxing Day. I can't remember. It was so full on. There was like 2 a day sometimes. But me being stupid, because I didn't plan it what I thought, I'll try and do it sequentially, but because it was Christmas, everybody was busy. And one thing I really wanted, 50% men, 50% women.
Well, I'm so glad you said that. Because one other thing I wanted to observe is that your podcast genuinely talks to women. And as we know, there's a big issue with the history of pop music, but I think particularly with the history of the Beatles, it's dominated by men and they don't seem to notice that actually women fans and women writers and women academics are a big part of the story. And you've effortlessly just made the whole thing much more inclusive in every sense, you know, in terms of diversity, as well as, you know, having more women.
Well, it's just obvious, isn't it, really? I don't, yeah. Like, it's only I realised that when I started hearing different, not necessarily Beatles podcasts, but yeah, it was difficult over Christmas because everybody was so busy. So I think it was like 60% male. I can't remember, that's but it wasn't 50-50, which I was a bit annoyed about. But everybody I really wanted to come on came on. And when you were saying about the community, it's the listeners are just, I wouldn't do this without the listeners because they are so brilliant. And they're all so supportive. They were the ones that, once I'd quit it in April 2018, they were the ones that said, yeah, come on, you've got to do more.
Oh, that's interesting. What sort of, yeah, tell me about them. What sort of comments did you get from them? What effect do they have on you?
Oh, they're just amazing. They're so supportive. That's all I can say. They're so supportive. Oh, I can't thank them enough. And what, again, when we were doing the Get Back episodes, I think we were in lockdown. I'm sure we were at the beginning of January 22, or it was one of the tiers or something, but it was a very grim time. Yeah. And a lot of them were watching that day of Get Back and then listening to the podcast, then coming on Twitter to talk about it. And it was just such a great, it was like hosting a party and all these people coming and just talking about the Beatles. Oh, it's lovely. In this episode, it's a delight to welcome Stuart McConey. Hello.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for asking me to do this.
Right, we've reached the point. We get the arrival of PC Ray Dagg and PC Ray Shaler, who at this point, they don't seem sure which door to knock on.
And no.
They talk to a disgruntled old puffin in a bowler hat, moaning about the noise. And they knock on the front door just as I've Got a Feeling starts.
That's right. This is sobering. Firstly, first observations. Was every young policeman in London called Ray at this point? I tried to do a bit of thinking about this. But hang on, think how old they are, because if you didn't know this, be prepared now to sit down. Mm. Ray Dagg is 19.
Yeah,
isn't that right? Ray Dagg is 19 at this point. He's younger than the Beatles when he comes to try and stop them. So, and I was trying to think. So, weren't we talking sort of late 40s? Who must have been popular in the late 40s? It was called Raymond that people were calling their little lads Ray. You know, because it's Ray Dagg and Ray Shaler. I mean, I don't know what to say about this. I don't. It's such a lovely experience, Get Back, that I don't want to slag anybody off. But if it has got a villain, who apart from Alan Klein, but that's another story. The conversation between Glyn Johns and Lennon is so brilliant about Alan Klein in the previous one. But where you want to shout at the television, John, listen to what Glyn Johns is saying.
Yeah.
Glyn Johns gets him. No. And you know, when John's going, yeah, well, he seems all right to me. And yeah, Glyn Johns is, don't you think he's a bit of a, like, odd man? You know, and all. Anyway, I digress, and that's someone else's business earlier in the series. But you want to cast Ray Dagg as a sort of pantomime villainy because you think, man, you're 19. You've had 30 complaints. Chill out, man. It does reinforce all your prejudices against PC Plod, doesn't it? And you think, oh, man, leave it. Chewing that chin strap like they do all the time, and I think, God, he's 19, and what is he thinking? And then I've watched it a couple of times since, and he's also a bit awkward and embarrassed, isn't he? Oh. Is there no way you could have done something else? And then his mate PC Ray Shaler, I love the bit when he goes, well, I would have thought you could dub that on afterwards, wouldn't you? So you're in this business, are you now? Yeah. All of a sudden, PC Plod knows all about making movies. I would have thought you could have dubbed that on afterwards, he says. Yeah. But it is great. But also, this is where the two more brilliant people, Mod Doorman Jimmy Clark, with his fantastic haircut and Crombie and tie, and Debbie the receptionist, where they do this fantastic, willful misrepresentation and deception, okay, where they claim what's going on, isn't it? And they, yeah, claim not to know. I think they're recording something, and they, yeah, and it's all this. And you, I just love that, how they, in a very sweet-natured way, they are obviously trying to hamper PC, mm-hmm, Ray Dagg, PC's Ray Dagg and Shayla's investigations, but do it in such a nice way. It's not aggressive, it's not combative. They're just absolutely trying to put them off the scent.
Do you know, it's funny, I regularly walk past that building on Savile Row, because I often walk after work from Broadcasting House to Waterloo Station on a Friday afternoon. There's always someone standing there looking up at it and taking a photo. Yeah. And one of the things I find really amusing is, of course, from the street. Sorry, I'm sucking a cough sweet, by the way. From the street, you absolutely cannot see anyone on the roof. You would never be able to see them. Mm. And I kind of find that's one of the weirdest things, is if you were there, you wouldn't have got a glimpse of them.
Yeah, one of my favourite moments from the whole Get Back thing, because for years I thought it was just a very, not selfish, but a very uninclusive thing to do by doing that, just letting people hear it. But in the full edit, the Peter Jackson edit, you actually see them crawl and peer over the edge. Yeah. So they were just excited. They were as excited as...
Yeah, it's not their fault that the sight lines weren't better.
Yeah.
Look, bloody, yeah, terrifying. I just keep thinking about the health and safety nightmare that could have been.
I know. Especially old Kevin Harrington, where he's crouching down right on the edge, holding up the lyrics. But the Ruttles, the scene where Neil Innes just kicks him off the roof.
That's right. Because I know they filmed the I Am the Walrus spoof in exactly the same...
In the aerodrome.
Aerodrome field.
Yeah. Oh, I need to go and watch the Ruttles.
I know. It's you know, I watched it again some point during the year, and it's so perfect.
Yeah. They had all the source material, didn't they, from what would eventually be anthology. We saw some of that footage on the Ruttles before we actually saw the real thing, which I love.
How do you mean, from the anthology?
Well, anthology was originally, it was going to be called The Long and Winding Road. And Neil Aspinall started it in 70, 71. So he already had a lot of the footage and he was compiling it together. And it took.
Did until... you mean interviews with those?
Well, as in like the Shea Stadium footage.
Oh, I see, right.
So, and they could then see what they were wearing and the studio footage. Yeah, I love all that.
Yeah, no, it's not been bettered. It's not been bettered. So where are things now with it? Have you got, because, you know, it will never die. You won't be allowed to.
I'm very...
And it's also, I should say, we're in this really strange moment where there's a huge amount of more Beatles-related archive material coming out. You know, very scholarly in some ways. Like there's a new book about the McCartney solo years.
The McCartney
69 to 73, Legacy Volume 1.
Yes.
Obviously, yeah. Mark Lewisohn's working on Volume 2 of his kind of definitive history of the Beatles. But it kind of feels like the scholarship's getting more intense and more encyclopedic the further distance we are in time from them. Mm. I don't know what you make of that and what the potential is for that for the podcast.
I don't know. I mean, there's loads of Beatles podcasts out there and each one does a different thing. Some go for the more scholarly direction. I don't know what I'd go for, really. But yeah, there's a lot of new information comes out. It used to be like every 6 months or so, some new fact would come out. But since, I mean, Get Back, obviously, that changed everything. I think Revolution in the Head kicked it all off with that level of research. Mark Lewisohn had always been doing it. But since Lewisohn's book, Beatles book, or a lot of Beatles books have tended to head in that direction.
And of course, you say Revolution in the Head. Is that Ian MacDonald?
MacDonald, yeah.
That was back in 96, I think, wasn't it? That,
yeah,
came out in paperback. So yeah. I remember being given a copy of it. And yeah, it was a new kind of... I wasn't used to reading that level of scholarly writing. I still feel a bit ambivalent about it. I mean, I probably... If I went back and read it, I'd probably really enjoy it. But I sometimes worry a little bit about whether it's like squeezing the juice and the joy out of the Beatles sometimes.
It's a brilliant book, you know, but he changed my mind about Across the Universe, because as a kid I used to love it. And then I read that book and I thought, oh, well, he's older than me. He's a published author. He knows better than I do. So I just, for years, assumed that I didn't like Across the Universe.
Because he didn't like it.
Yeah. I think a lot of it impacted a lot of people. Again, that's why Eggpod are trying to make everything as positive as possible, which can be a challenge sometimes, depending on the album.
Absolutely. So I wonder how your day-to-day life is affected by running the Eggpod. Like, you know, when you walk down the street, you go to your day job, a Beatles tune's flitting through your head. Do you find yourself living in this kind of Beatles-verse?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I think it's improved the way I listen to music, because I always look for the best, you know, in songs that I might not have liked before. But yeah, I do think about it a lot, which I do need a bit of a break, I think, because I'm just constantly thinking, oh, this album, I wonder if X person would want to speak about that. And if anybody mentions the Beatles or they mention an album, my ears prick up. Oh, maybe they could come on.
Are you going to redo all the early albums again at some point with different people?
Yeah, a lot of people have said that. And I think, yeah, I did one the other day with Christine Feldman Barrett, who's written a book.
She's a good cultural historian, isn't she?
Yeah, and she did Meet the Beatles, the US album, which is just really interesting because it's
great choice
comparing the way the Beatles were introduced in America. And yeah, I love speaking to her about that. So yeah, there's all the American ones. But yeah, I think a lot of people have said, yeah, redo them, because there's so much to say. You can't cover it in one episode. Yeah. So yeah.
Yeah. One of the other things I should mention since we last spoke is I spent a lot of time in Bradford, where I'm on the advisory board of the National Science and Media Museum, which has inherited the photographic archives of the old Herald newspaper, which became the Sun, but its archives up until it's quite late in the 60s, I think, the entirety of them, like they're literally the giant filing cabinets. They fill this whole room. It's not quite the scale of that last scene in Indiana Jones, but, you know, it's a room full of these original filing cabinets and handwritten ledgers going back to the 19th century and it's all their photographic archives. And when I went up, I got a tour by the curator there, and he said, what do you want to see? Because, you know, there's like a million subjects. I said, let's look at the Paul McCartney file. Because I think that might have been in the run-up to me doing that interview. And they opened the file, and there were the photographs, that some of which I recognised, that you've seen, you know, printed in newspapers, or it's a photograph from and it's something you saw on television. And what was really interesting was seeing photographs, the raw photograph, and the way that they mark them up and crop them. So there was, I think when he and Jane Asher were still a couple, they were engaged, there was a photograph of them, and obviously they had a bit of a news conference when they got engaged. And you see all these lines, almost like arrows, zoning in on them. And I felt there was some kind of amazing metaphor for how they'd lived all this intense period of time as a young couple under that level of quite terrifying media scrutiny.
Yeah.
And when you actually see the handwritten original sort of photo print marked up, you know, it's like an impression left. But, you know, there's like an echo of the hands of those newspaper editors framing them and cropping them and fitting them in, and let's make this headline, and that sense of the pursuit of them. I found that quite moving's the wrong word, slightly unsettling. I think it gave me an insight into how bizarre it must be to live under that level of scrutiny. Dare I say it, topical comparison, Harry and Meghan. I know that there wasn't that vitriol laid at, you know, any of the Beatles on the whole, but just it's something unreal about the way that human beings hound it. And I do think the Beatles got madness. I'm sure I said this to you. I was watching a lot of archive footage actually preparing for interviewing Paul McCartney. I found on archive websites and things. And when Ringo was having his tonsils out, there was this media scrum outside the hospital asking him all about his tonsils.
Yeah.
Or when, you know, his wife had their second baby. And you just think, really inane, dumb questions. And he's having to stand there and answer them. Or when they found him and Maureen on their honeymoon, and they're having to come out into the garden of this hotel and stand there being asked questions while they're on their flipping honeymoon.
Yeah.
I don't know how they handled it so well.
I was watching the Maisel's Brothers film the other day, which is their first tour of America. And that's probably the first and last time, really, because they're so excited. And they're sitting listening to the radio as Murray the K plays She Loves You or whatever it was.
Oh, yes.
And they're just filled with excitement. And what they didn't realise, that was not going to stop. You get the impression, oh, we'll just quickly go through this madness for a few 10 days or whatever. Then we'll fly back to the UK and it'll all be over. But it didn't stop to this day for Paul.
I know.
How do you deal with that? I guess you deal with it by being
Paul McCartney. Well, he does very well. Yeah. Very well. And as the thing I said to you, he's got an incredible team around him, you know, who were young and dynamic and really on it. So I think, you know, when you have people you can trust to kind of be your gatekeepers and negotiate things. And I was just thinking, you know, that gig he did at the Cavern and that set list, they repeated it on BBC Four, I think, last year. And it's such an amazing set list, really early stuff, late solo stuff. And the energy with which he performs and the love of it. I mean, you can't fake that, can you? He loves what he does. I think that's what's so gripping.
Really. Yeah. I mean, again, Get Back, but all he wanted to do, let's get back out on the road. First thing he does with Wings, get rehearsing, do the university tours. He just can't stop himself.
Well, I was speaking to the producer who worked on, there was a McCartney at the BBC archive programme, they put it again around the time of Get Back. And sadly, it wasn't what I think the producer had originally intended. But he found all this amazing archive footage, some of which made it into the final edit, which is when he was touring with Wings in the early days of the band. And he said what was really clear from the news footage was that journalists had been dispatched on the assumption that no one was interested in the Beatles, no one remembered them, and no one would come to see them. And they were almost there to see, let's see if we can capture the humiliation. And of course, these gigs were full of people who were thrilled that Paul McCartney was back on the road, and crowds and hordes. And so, you know, I love that that was actually part of the story is... Again, I keep coming back to the way journalists wanted a certain kind of negative story. And in spite of themselves, they find themselves reporting a much more positive one.
Yeah. I mean, Jan Wenner's obviously the culprit for much of that. But that carried on for so long. The Philip Norman book, Shouts, that was one of the first books I got. And I think it was in the Beatles monthly reprints that I used to get. Because I thought, Paul McCartney, what an arse. Throughout the whole book, that's how he comes across. And then I started reading stuff in the Beatles Monthly about... That was the only way you could really get regular news, by the way, back in those days.
Yeah, well, you should say we haven't even talked about the fact that the internet wasn't there when we were growing up, so it was all little bits of magazines and things.
But the letters page, people were writing in saying the same thing. What is this? And I thought, oh, so maybe don't believe what you read. That was one of the first times I ever considered that option.
Do you know the one thing I'll say? Because, again, I'm thinking back over all the research I did and I read the Philip Norman Shout biography and I read the Hunter Davis one. And while there's stuff I will never forgive in the Philip Norman book, including, I think there's a line where he says George Harrison was basically an untalented or mediocre guitarist who got lucky, the phrase who got lucky. I mean, you know, it's just not true. You know, never mind whether one has an interpretation of anything. It's just mean and not true. But I did think what the book did capture, and no other book I have read has captured quite successfully, is he went back to Hamburg when all those people were still alive. You know, like that old, the really scary bouncer was still around.
Oh yeah.
And he found him. And he had that sense of this world that was still there. You know, this very dangerous, edgy world of, you know, the Reeper Barn. And I think that book captured it.
Yes.
Very successfully and got some of those voices. And as you know, I'm a huge fan of kind of oral history and got them down on paper. And so the early part of that book in particular is unmatched for its, you know, historical record.
Yeah. There was that footage on the BBC archive a couple of years ago of Alan Williams. It's great footage. He'd discovered the Star Club tapes. Yeah, that's, you'd love that. You'd love that footage because he's very much like a David Jason in Only Fools and Horses. He's kind of got that vibe going on.
Wide boy vibe.
It's lovely footage. Hunt it out. I promise you'll love it.
Well, one of the things I'm most fascinated with, as you may know, I go to Liverpool a lot these days for various reasons. And I'm fascinated by, you know, the remnants of all these old assembly halls and town halls and places where they played gigs. And I know Mark Lewisohn has written very movingly, actually, in Tune In, to how frustrated he is that local authority planners and councillors and, you know, leadership are still demolishing these places which have so much history. And not just because they're associated with the Beatles, but because actually they're really beautiful buildings that were built for the community. And, you know, they could still be part of our living cultural lives. Yeah. You know, they should be part of our cultural lives. It's not just that we need to preserve in aspect any building that a Beatle stepped into. It's that that period in their lives reminds us of when sort of civic society was really rich and full, and post-war the government had built all these amazing places and beautiful architectural styles and materials, apart from the ones that are filled with asbestos. I know there are issues with those.
Yeah.
Where, you know, people could hire them. And you know, I'm fascinated by that early calendar of the Beatles' lives, where they're playing these quite small-scale gigs for, you know, little societies and local community groups, and you hire the Beatles as a local band to perform there. And for various reasons, I went around Birkenhead. I'd never been to Birkenhead, which is across the Mersey, and I know they must have played there. And Birkenhead is like, it's like this amazing parallel version of Liverpool. In fact, it's so much like the version of Liverpool that I got from watching Yellow Submarine. You know those Georgian houses and streets that Ringo yeah. wanders through, and it's sort of a cartoon, but it's sort of recognisably real and based on photographic imagery. Birkenhead's like that. It's like a dream version of Liverpool. Beautiful, grand Georgian squares and gardens and, you know, these old places, some of which are derelict, but there's a huge effort going into reviving them. There's all kinds of stuff going on culturally in Birkenhead, which is so interesting. Yeah. And for me, that's all, you know, that's partly why we love the Beatles, because they represent something incredibly powerful and in a weird way bigger than the Beatles, about the power of post-war British culture, you know, and all these young people making rock and roll, partly imported, but making it out of, you know, like the way they made skiffle out of old soap boxes.
Yeah.
String. I mean, they literally made instruments that way.
Yeah, it's lovely. It's, again, it's that world, going back to it, but I wish I'd been around in the 60s just to experience all of that. It does feel like it's black and white up to around 1964. And then the colour of psychedelia changed everything. And then it just got a bit denim-y into the 70s.
Yeah.
That magic went.
I know. So I have to ask you, do you have a favourite Beatle record now?
Oh, I can't.
It's like asking you to choose between your children.
It is, yes.
Or your beloved pets or something.
Yeah. I do have a favourite solo album. That is Paul and Linda McCartney's Ram. From 1971.
Because?
It's as close as you'll get to a Beatles album for me. It was like 1970 did McCartney, which had really appalling reviews. And so I think he took the reaction to that quite personally. So he pulled out all the stops for the next album. Apparently there was a lot of wacky-backy going around at the time, but...
Surely not.
Who'd have thought? Yeah, yeah. And it's just all the magic of these songs. They're so well written. And for years, my one memory of that, going back to that Illustrated Record book, was reading the review of that. And I think, I can't remember the review, but it was very poor. And me and my mate Norm, when we were kids, went into town and we saw Ram for about £1.99 or something. We thought, oh, we've got to get that because it's a Paul McCartney album. And we went back to his house and we were giggling because we'd read the review on the Roy Carr book. Because what we used to do at Christmas was deliberately buy each other really crap albums. So they'd be about 45p in our price, and that would be our Christmas. So I got The Best of Andy Kim one year, and he got an album called Kevin Dunn and the Regiment of Women, which was 15p. So we bought this album on that premise, thinking it was going to be a load of rubbish.
Yeah.
And we put it on, and we started, Too Many People was in the first one, and we were sort of laughing, going, oh, look, this is going to be rubbish. And by the end of the song, we were like, bloody hell, this is amazing. It's like a Beatles album. And again, it's that don't believe what you read. And to this day, I don't think he's ever done anything better.
But it's like, you know, go back to early reviews of the Beatles, you know, I'm so glad that in the end, the truth will out. You know, people said terrible things about them and dismissed them. And over time, obviously, the numbers can't be wrong.
Yeah.
Isn't it a line on an Elvis album, you know, 500 million sales or can't be wrong or something? Or,
that's,
you know,
it, yes.
I mean, I know that you could argue that the other way, to say there are a lot of people who watch some TV shows which I think are atrocious and I think they could be wrong.
Yeah, but I think also, Linda McCartney, when she first sort of hooked up with Paul, she was getting abuse in the streets and people were tripping her up and shouting abuse at her because she had the audacity to meet a Beatle. And I remember back in the noughties, was it, when the internet really kicked off and there was audio of her singing live and they just dubbed out everything else bar her vocals. And people were just ripping it out of her. And you just hope that she did appreciate before she died that, you know, people did respect and love her, because it'd be awful to think that, you know,
I'm sure she did, yeah.
Because that's a good thing about this podcast as well. If I get people, like Michael Lindsay Hogg was on,
yeah,
and I've got the chance to tell him, because he said he had a load of abuse online. He said, I've turned social media off now. I was going, well, not from where I've been looking. And it was just so good to tell him, and he seemed really chuffed with that. So this is a good opportunity. I love it, moments like that.
I've got a feeling deep inside, oh yeah. Oh yeah. I've got a feeling I can't hide, no, no, oh, no.
Can I ask what you felt like when you first saw Get Back regarding watching yourself? I think you've been very modest I think you said once that you were seen as the comic relief, which I don't think is the case at all. I mean, there is a funny moment on the roof, but we won't talk about that. But it just makes you appreciate what you are having to deal with. You're kind of like surrounded by this utter chaos. But it must have been weird watching yourself as a, you know, 28-year-old.
Well, yeah. And in those years, I sometimes had what was called a weight problem. And I talked to Peter about it afterwards. In some shots, I look what you might call reasonably slim and fit. And then in other shots, I just look very fat. And there's that shot of when Ringo, and I just got, I'm like this little fat Porky Pig. And I'm saying to Peter, did I change from day one day to the next that I was fat one day and then the next day? So, well, if that's what it looks like, I guess that's the answer. You did. Fortunately, I have as little to do with social media as any sane person would. And friends of mine said, oh God, you're getting a lot of flack from Get Back. But I couldn't figure out, my friends told me, but I didn't see much fit myself. I couldn't understand why, because I think people thought, they didn't know, like you and I've been talking today, they didn't know the backstory of this at all. And I guess they thought that I'd kind of wandered onto the set from Bond Street and wanted to get them to do what I wanted them to do, and didn't know that I'd done the two videos before and the two videos before, and that we'd done Hey Jude, and the Beatles had asked me to do it because they thought the work was good, and et cetera, et cetera. So there was no cognizance of the kind of the back relationship. And there was no cognizance really of, like you and I have talked about today, particularly that it was going to be a concert, it was going to be a concert film, then boom, overnight it's a documentary. Okay, well, let's hold on to your hats, let's see what we can do. And also, I think people thought, because I've got this hyphenated name, that I'm English. I mean, I'd love to be English, but I'm really American, grew up mainly in American, if not America, Ireland, because my mother and my grandparents were all Irish, and my father lived in Ireland. And I wanted to be a baseball player. So I'm not English in that sense. I mean, I lived and worked there a lot, and I had some great times, but I'm not whoever they'd invented me as. That's not who I am.
Oh, well, Michael, I'm very sorry to hear that, because I think on, well, Twitter, certainly, there's a very, very strong, and it's really grown in the last 5 or so years, Beatles fan base on there. And everybody has loved the amount of love for you, and people like Mal Evans and Glyn Johns who appeared in that. It's been absolutely tangible. So there's a lot of that stuff goes on. But I would say in the circles I move in, there's been, I mean, it's all done with love. It's all kind of like, oh, Mal's drinking from that stripy cup again. You know, there's been a lot of love. That's the minutiae show we're into. We're into the mugs that they were drinking from. So, yeah, please.
Well, Chris, you know, I that means a lot to me, what you've said, because I know you're very connected to what we've all been talking about, and you know how, you do know how it all worked, and you are know what's going on, and that is that's good to hear. So thank you.
Yeah, well, I keep coming back to, I think that's what's really great about the Egg Pod, is it's positive. It's not that one can't have opinions, but you don't have to slag people off in this incredibly personal way. You know, just talk about the things that you love.
Yeah.
And yeah, and it's not to say people can't be unpositive. I mean, God, you know, we're not all doing things hoping to be blessed by the subjects. But I think one of the things that social media's done is it's made it so much easier for people to just slag someone off. And then everyone just piles in, a pile on. Yeah. And I find that quite depressing, you know, grown people doing it. So, Chris, are there any surprising things you've learned about the Beatles in making the Egg Pod?
Yes, there's some I love.
This is not a question that I gave you in advance at all, is it?
Absolutely. Let me just check my notes. Jude Rogers, firstly, Paul McCartney's housekeeper in the 1970s was the mother of Adamant.
Yeah, he's talked about that quite a lot.
Has he? Oh, see, that was news to me. And he used to walk Martha The Sheepdog.
That's right. I know. So well, it's a reason. It's one of. I didn't know it when I put Adamant at the top of the list of people I'd like to interview, but it's like yet another reason why he's got so much to talk about.
Yeah.
A pop star to have grown up with that awareness of what being a pop star is from the inside, from being the son of his cleaner. Wow.
Oh, imagine. Mark Lewisohn, obviously. One thing I'd never really thought about before was the Beatles' live performances. There'd be a song by John, a song by Paul, a song by George.
That's right.
All in equal measure.
Yes.
And prior to that, I thought, oh, yeah. And it was only when they had to do the singles, which were primarily John and Paul, that George was kind of squeezed out of the equation on the live performance, as well as everything else.
Yeah, no, Mark did a really beautiful moment of that in his, you know, he's done that live show. Yes. 62, the sort of history of Beatles 1962 with 62 objects. And there is a whole section where he just runs through a set list and shows you exactly that. It's John, Paul, George, John, Paul, George. You know, everyone's getting equal share.
Oh, that Mark Lewisohn show is super. Something I learned from that, not from Megpod. Dick Rowe, you know, he didn't turn down the Beatles. Brian Epstein turned down Dick Rowe, which kind of changes everything.
There's a lot of stories coming out now about things like that, aren't there? Like, you know, it turns out that the Live and Let Die producers didn't want a female singer instead of Paul McCartney and Wings at all. And there's now written documentation to show that.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing. I asked him a question, actually, at the end about, do you now rely solely on documentation rather than interviews? And he said yes, because people's memories, they aren't going to remember stuff to the level that he needs to know. So it's 99%. Documentation he relies on now.
That's so interesting. Yeah, no, there's a lot of research about how memory works, and memory, it sort of reinforces false ideas. If you're something sown in, as a seed in you, your memory of it will change.
Well, like I was saying about Across the Universe, I was convinced I hated that song, and I thought, actually, no, I read about hating that song. I actually love it.
Right, what else did you learn? What else surprised you?
Just silly things, really. Kate Robbins said Lady Madonna might be about her mum.
Oh.
And she questioned Paul about it, and he said, maybe. You know how he doesn't really give much away, but I love the idea that it is, you know, scrimping and saving. She had a tough time. But, yeah, and I think Julia Baird, when she was talking about John's childhood, and it's something I've since spoken to a lot of people in there of similar age to Julia, it happened all the time. You know, if kids were born out of wedlock or it was deemed to be morally unfit for the streets, and it, what would the neighbours think? They were given away. And she said at the time that went on all the time. I've since spoken to a lot of people that age. I said, oh, yeah, my cousin is actually my sister. I only found out 30 years after. And that surprised me, just of that sort of 1940s culture or UK culture. Horrendous.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so sorry. But yeah, I think it's great if we're remembering all the negative aspects of the past too, which is, you know, the horrific treatment of unmarried mothers in particular, this demonisation of women who dared to have sex outside marriage, and all the pressures that went with it, whether it's people being forced into marriages they didn't want or abandonment or everything else. And there is this whole generation, I mean, we know about the Beatles, how many of them were raised in broken homes or by single parents. I mean, Paul's mother died so young. And I remember interviewing Roger Waters a few years ago, and his father was in the RAF and I think was killed in action. So he was an orphan. Yeah. And he never knew his dad. I think I'm right. And I forgot how many of that generation of pop stars didn't have dads. It's really interesting. Or didn't have a mum, you know. I mean, Eric Idle obviously wasn't a pop star, but I sort of was, wasn't he? But, you know, his friendship with George Harrison. And he was sent to a boarding school for RAF children and had a horrific time, but did get into Cambridge as a result. And I'm fascinated by his friendship with George Harrison, which he said was like a friendship of teenage girls, that men found their feelings and their emotions despite these really terrible starts in life that they had. At a time when men were always being told, you don't show your feelings. You certainly didn't show your emotion at a boarding school where the bullying was rife. And I love that they've grown up into kind people.
Absolutely.
Although I think Eric Idle first to admit that he had some pretty wild times as well, but anyway.
Oh, yes. One final thing I learnt, and it's from you, is the buses theory, which I love.
Hey, this is now official Beatle fact, is it not?
Yes, you heard it here first.
But remind those who haven't heard our discussion about the buses theory. How would you sum it up?
Oh, no, go on, you tell it. You tell it so much better.
Okay, so my theory is that Paul McCartney loves buses and was always obsessed with them, and it turns out this was true. And I pieced this together listening to various interviews. So when I made The Stars of Sgt. Pepper, which was about a 12-hour programme on Radio 4 Extra in 2017, all about the faces on the album, we found an archive interview of him saying how the cover of Sgt. Pepper was designed to be exciting and rich, that you could take it out the bag on the bus on the way home from Lewis's. He had this real sense of being a commuter. It used to be, I think he said it was half an hour or more each way into grammar school and going into town from the suburbs. You know, the buses were the network that everyone used. And so, you know, he met George on the bus because they both went to grammar school together. I think he did first see John on the bus, although they may not have been properly introduced till that, you know, Walton fate. And so a lot of his key relationships and moments happened on buses. And there's songs like that song about picking up empty cigarette cases off the floor of the bus. I used to ride a big green bus. On my way to work, I rode a big green bus. Those are all memories about his first brief job on a building site or a delivery site that he worked at. And his grandson wrote a whole thesis at university about that act, the Public Transport Act of, is it 1948? I thought it was art post-war. And it was Herbert Morrison. It was Peter Mandelson's dad. And it was this act that brought in this massive network of nationalised bus routes across the country. So you could get from anywhere to anywhere very cheaply. And so Paul McCartney and George would travel across town on the bus to pick up, learn a chord they'd heard about from a guitarist. You know, that level of travel. And the comparison I make is that when Ken Livingstone was mayor, he introduced free transport in London for the under 18s. And in fact, if you're a student, you can get up to 19. And so my children's generation all grew up travelling across London for free on the buses. And in their own way, you know, it enables so much. It's very exciting.
Yeah. So there you go.
Yeah.
Highlight of the show.
Can I thank you, Chris Shaw, for being a guest on your own podcast and for being game for this? But your podcast is amazing. It's, you know, and I have to tell you, it's brought me so much joy. It's been a thrill to ever be part of it and to get to know you. And I think it has forged friendships between people like us, hasn't it?
Oh, I hope so. Definitely. Yeah.
You know, and just enabled us to celebrate all the things we love. You know, I think there used to be this big distinction between work and fun, like, you know, listening to your favourite band is like a hobby, and now they kind of overlap in a way, don't they?
Yeah.
Even if you're not getting paid for making your podcast, you know, it's sort of, it's part of, we wear our identities more publicly now, and the two are sort of intertwined.
Somebody did once contact me about you, saying when you came on Eggpod, it was a bit like Angela Rippon going on Morecambe and Wise, because the perception had completely changed. I think it was meant in the nicest possible way.
I think it was. I was going to say, don't expect me to doing any high kicks. I'm afraid I'm not a dancer. But what a lovely thing to say. I have to say, I know Angela Rippon. She is amazing. She's a goddess. I was on House of Games with her.
Does she like the Beatles?
I didn't ask her, but she's, you know, she's such a professional. She's a real sister. Yeah. Oh, what a lovely thing to say.
So I don't know who's going to close this, me or you.
You have to close it with a song.
Ooh.
Pick something and tell us why, and then that could be the end.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like, what might be the next Beatle record you'd go and listen to?
It's winter, isn't it? So probably something off Abbey Road. Oh, the end. Let's just end with the end.
I was thinking of that.
There you go. And in the end. So, Samira, thank you very much. I don't know how to end this.
I know. Thank you. Thank you, Chris, for all the joy. And Happy New Year to all the egg podders.
Yes.
Let's see what we're doing in 5 years' time. God knows what the level of scholarship will be, like how many books will be out there about the Beatles. Man.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Goodbye. Hey!